Sing for you. Every time we get to all our welcome, you'll all join on that part. Everybody sings 2 and 5, the women sing 3, men sing 4. You get that? The men sing 2, 4, 5, the women sing 2, 3, 5. We all sing for the praise.
Let us build a house where love can dwell and all can safely live. A place where saints and children tell how hearts learn to forgive. Built of hopes and dreams and visions, rock of faith and vault of grace. Here the love of Christ shall end divisions.
Thank you. just what an absolute grace this is that you have all gathered, members of this long-term community, venturing through the snowiest February on recorded history. Every community that lives through winter at Holden has to have something it can say about how it has endured life here in a greater struggle than the communities before. That's very important to us. And then we tell these stories again and again. Were you here the winter when the kilowatts were down to 27? That's the lowest. And what it was like to live with one light bulb per person. And the stories then of those who tried to press the human boundaries, who would sneak around at night and turn off freezers and refrigerators in order to heat an oven to make chocolate chip cookies, the smell of which would come out of a chalet and into the night air and signal that someone had broken the rules, had tried to make their life sweeter and chocolatier than other people's lives. The story of the man whose marriage nearly ended over a single piece of toast during a time when the energy was so low, and Kent longed for toast and made a peace, and the energy, the power went down yet one more time. We tell these stories at Holden over and over like a liturgy to bind community to community to community, so that those of us who lived here during this 5 years will have our piece of a long story to tell, that we need to add what was precious and unique and dangerous and wounding and healing about our time here. But those stories are made most whole when they are bound to the stories that go back to the beginning. And not only the beginning of Holden Village, though those stories are rich and wondrous. And this week we have committed into the Saints of Light, Will Bergstrand, who was among the very first pioneers in this place. But we also tell the stories of the mining days and hold reunions here, so the children of the miners can return to this town that they remember and gather and tell their stories about going to school in this remote but necessary schoolhouse. But there was also a story before the miners came, you know. It was the story of glaciers, of rivers cutting ravines, of avalanches pounding down the rock, creating lakes and rivulets and carving Martin's Ridge. Stories that go beyond and before human memory, long before anyone was here who could tell the story. And yet we try in some deep way to connect ourselves to that first rhythm in this valley, the rhythm of wind through the aspen and water over rock and cascading snow down hillside. Because the story of this winter with the snowiest February on recorded history cannot stand alone. It must be linked to 40 years of Holden's life as a place of renewal for people of faith. It must be linked to the days of the miners, and before that to the prospectors, and before that to the deer and the cougar and the bear and the marmot. It is a liturgy that we enter when we tell the story of Holden, and we tell it best when we know it well and when we have heard it from our elders. And among us is Tom, who knows the stories as well as anyone, and we cherish his presence because he, though young, has memories that go back farther than mine, this place. So I need Tom in this village. But I also need young Tom and young Margaret, who attend our grade school, who are forming images in this place that will blossom into stories much later when they say, this is what it was like as a child in that place. This is how big the snow looked that winter to one who stands just this high, and that's the place I lost my front tooth. What is liturgy? And why do we need it and love it and long for it? And why are we suspect of its power sometimes? And why has it fallen, we think, on hard times among us? One of the reasons is we are afraid of what we do not know. Both the stories that have gone before us, we wonder, how is it shaping for us to hear again those ancient stories and to enter that ancient liturgy and pattern? Isn't that archaic, and aren't we done with that? And haven't we moved on when we can in fact have virtual community, they tell me, in a world where you can be networked, which is a verb now. You can enter chat rooms on your computer and have conversations with people who are in Tokyo or Liberia or Antarctica, or as one person told me today, with the guy who's two doors down on your dorm floor, but you don't really want to walk down and chat with him, so you just dial him up or whatever. What is the word? Plug him in? What's the word, Marty?
Go online, bro.
Go online. To go online. We can't. We could just go online with one another and make a community that way, I suppose. But during these days together, I hope that we go deeply into the mystery of liturgy and how these patterns shape us and why, for what purpose and to what end. You will hear a number of phrases to describe the liturgy or the Eucharist that Christians have gathered within for 2,000 years. You will hear it called during these days a journey with a beginning and high points and an ending. You might hear it called a drama that all of the people are in and actors in this drama. You'll hear it called a time of world making. To enter liturgy is to be in the process of making a world into which we might live, or entering into God's divine world for a while to see more clearly the world we live in day by day. Tonight, the image I want to use is liturgy as rhythm, as knowing the deepest rhythms of human life, the particular rhythms of the story that is ours in both the Hebrew scripture and in the witness of the New Testament, and the even more particular rhythms of the communities in which you live and work and serve and worry and grow old and give birth and sit with the dying. Those particularities join to the deepest rhythms about being human and human in the presence of God. So I've chosen as a way to begin a piece of music that I like very much. I have no idea if the composer, Paul Simon, who's not the senator, the Lutheran senator, but the shorter one, I have no idea if he intended this song to be a liturgical song, a song about the rhythms of liturgy and life. Perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. But as I have learned from my creative musical friends, once you create a piece, you let it go, and then we all get to make of it what we want. So, Tom, do you want this? Here, wait, I can do it from afar.
This is
We walk the length of our days. The story about falling and calling our name, God's name out. The story of, as a community, connecting to the deepest rhythms that are beneath and within and around us. To understand liturgy, I think, requires understanding the roots of the rhythm, and to begin to know why that rhythm remains, even now in a postmodern, probably post-denominational era. What are the roots of the rhythm? And what is the rhythm that remains? And how can we form a people by the power of the Holy Spirit to walk in that rhythm with the saints who have gone before them? The deepest roots of the rhythm, I think, are in the created order already. And they are the rhythms of the created order as they are embodied and enfleshed by a particular people in a particular place and time. Joseph walked the length of his days in the southern hemisphere under African skies. We walk our days in a different hemisphere and under other skies, and the fact that the particularity of our hemisphere will shape the rhythm of our worship. And yet, we don't forget it is but one sky, and the pale yellow moon that shone in Joseph's eye is the same pale yellow moon that we see. So connected to the rhythm of Joseph's life, and yet the rhythms are distinctive in North America, in your community, in this place. The rhythm of liturgy is rooted in the mighty acts of God. These are the stories of Scripture in which a community has saved for us over generations the ways they have seen God alive and well and working in the world. But more than the mighty acts of God, or with the mighty acts of God, is also the struggle of a people in a particular time and place to know and understand what God was doing, or to live in the mystery of God's acts. It is their struggle with injustice, with the orphan and the widow, their struggle with hunger, their struggle with loss, their longing to understand the mystery of birth and the mystery of death. So the mighty acts of God, but also the struggles of the people, to know how those acts reach out and pull them in to the rhythm of God. This is the story of how we begin to remember. And a rhythm both evocative of and responsive to the deepest human needs after the dream of falling and calling God's name out. Maybe this is just so Lutheran that it's not helpful. But I think we do have this deep dream, this deep memory, corporate memory among us of falling. And in the falling of calling out for safety, for someone to catch us in midair, we have a corporate memory that the life we live now, the world we see now, is not, surely not, what God intended from the beginning. So the story of Adam and Eve is part of a way of getting at that corporate memory, that remembering of our falling, and in our falling of calling out a name, calling out in our descent for one to come and cushion the fall or lift us up again. Further, what we do on Sunday morning, particularly in this rhythm of gathering the many into one, opening up the Word of God, then feasting on that Word of grace and sending the people out again into the world, shapes our very living and our dying in accordance with God's dream and God's desire for the universe. I think when we worship, what we're doing is just as we were doing today, dancing with Mary. And this man should get a prize. He sang, he clapped, he did two steps to the left, claps two steps to the right, clap, and ate ice cream at the same time. This man is rehearsing the rhythms of God's reign. Did you see how kind of awkward we were at first when, you know, a couple of us who you know, just don't, never had ballet or, you know, are just sort of rhythmless? Are there any of those? Well, Dan and I are in that group, select. Tim, are you in that group? Yeah. So here we go, we're counting, you know, right? Two.
Yeah.
Two. Clap. And then my clap is off. But did you know, Jan's clap is always right on because that's just in her bones. Jen just moves. She doesn't have to count. And she knows when to clap. See? But in the course of that, we got better, didn't we? Eventually, as Mary kept singing and we kept singing, we were able to sing and move and clap at the same time until the whole people were walking together, as if rehearsing the rhythms of a life that we need to live when we leave this place. Those of us who have sung and clapped and danced and eaten ice cream all at the same time together are shaped differently for our life in the world. We will recognize one another. I've danced with you. I've sung with you. I clapped a little off from you, but mostly with you. Worship is a rehearsal for a rhythm, the rhythm of God's reign in the universe. It's to learn to move, let me say, in time with God's own heartbeat. Or as Paul Simon says, the powerful pulsing of love in God's veins. I just think that is a gorgeous, gorgeous image of being in the presence of God. The powerful pulsing of love in God's veins. That's a rhythm, isn't it? What would it mean to rehearse the rhythm of that pulsing, to live according to the beat of God's own heart, which is revealed to us, you know, in Jesus, in his life and in his suffering, in his dying, in his rising, in his breathing out of the Holy Spirit upon us. I think in John 20, when Jesus comes into that upper room and breathes peace into those frightened disciples, and what he's saying is, this is the rhythm of God's breath. This is the powerful pulsing of God's love in God's veins. And now, my dear beloved ones, it's your breath and your pulse too. So stop hunkering down inside this little room afraid of what's on the other side of the door. Go out and breathe it. Go out and let that pulse be the rhythm by which you live, so you might be living signs of the risen Christ, the wounded and broken and healing heart of God. Learning these rhythms, which are the rhythms of liturgy, and teaching them to our children and our children's children and to those who come as strangers and seekers in our midst, is all part of the practice, the rehearsal. So one might come to your door and say, you know, I worshiped with the Lutherans once, or the Episcopalians, or a liturgical Methodist church, or the Roman Catholics, and, you know, I didn't get it. I didn't get it right away. I couldn't find my way through the book, or I didn't know when to stand and when to sit, and you have to say, oh, there's a rehearsal here. It will take time. And trust me, you can use me as a sign. Susan Briel can learn to step and clap and sing at the same time. Trust me. Let me dance with you these early steps. Rather than saying at the door, oh, you didn't catch the dance the first time, we'll stop dancing. Mm. We'll just come and sit so everybody knows how to sit. Mm. And we'll do a program for you, because everybody knows how to watch a program. And then you can even go online with each other. Joseph, who walks under African skies, can't you just see him? Just as black as the night and as beautiful and velvety as the night. Wouldn't say, don't stop walking like that. It takes time to learn it. It takes time and rehearsal to enter the rhythms of the pulsing of love in God's veins. In other words, when we gather on Sunday, we join a deep, deep rhythm that has been pulsing for generations, a rhythm that is gathered up in praise of the God who created all things. We enter into the rhythm of redemption, the Paschal mystery. We enter into a rhythm of dying and rising. That's part of the dance and the drama we do on Sunday mornings. A rehearsal for our dying and rising again and again through the length of our days and at the end of our days as well. We remember the pattern, the pulse, the life of Jesus. And we enter into his story again and again until the pattern of his life becomes the rhythm of our own. To hear the stories again and again until those stories are ours. I know the stories of the miners in this valley, and that story no longer belongs alone to those who live there. It's my story too. I live with the buildings they left. I live with the pollution that remains. I live with their story now incorporated into mine, and knowing their story helps me live in closer rhythm of the pulsing of life in this valley. We move into a Eucharistic rhythm as well, that wonderful rhythm of receiving grace that comes first and responding with gratitude. It's another one of the rhythms of our liturgy together, the reception of grace, the response of gratitude. Karl Barth, one of my favorite quotations. Grace and gratitude belong together like heaven and earth. Grace evokes gratitude like the voice, its echo. And gratitude follows grace like thunder, the lightning. It's a rhythm. There isn't one without the other. No gratitude precedes grace. It's part of the dance. We learn. We rehearse the rhythms and the words and the gestures and the songs and the conversations and the deeds of the reign of God. We are practicing when we worship to bear the reign of God into the world, to more fully show forth the incarnation of God's love through the pulsing of love in our own veins. When I was pregnant with my firstborn, before she was ever named or seen. I became aware of the rhythms of her world within the womb. Constant sound of my heartbeat, the pulse of my blood, the rushing waves of amniotic fluid. It was a watery and rhythmic life that she had before she had breath. And it was with awe and amazement that I watched her own tiny little heartbeat on the screen. You know, when they put the petroleum jelly in the Doppler and you get to look up and you see this little heartbeat, but it was syncopated to mine. It wasn't the same as mine. And I remember also with my second born, watching her little heartbeat, and it was irregular. It was itself syncopated. Oh, should I be afraid of this little offness of her heart? Did this signal danger, that the rhythm of her heart was not constant? Well, no, as it turned out, she has what's called a benign mama. That just means she's syncopated and it's not dangerous. It's a gift and a grace. And I thought of the rhythm of this baby's world when I walked, and when I rocked in the big oak chair where I prayed in the mornings, and when I swam, I had this wonderful vision, you know, of my baby swimming inside of me, and me swimming in a greater water, and that water swimming in a greater world. You know, it's like that Our Town, you know, when she writes the address on the letter, and the eye of God finally at the end. Somehow the rhythm of this little swimmer, unknown and unnamed and unseen, was part of a very, very big cosmic rhythm, and yet so particular. She was being formed, the psalmist says, knit inside her mother's womb, that God watched every bone taking shape in secret and being formed in the hidden depths, that God saw her body grow according to a divine design. I wonder if our ancestors in the faith were trying to say in Psalm 139 that before you even knew it, the rhythm of God's love and life was being knit into your bones, into your sinews, into the pulsing of your heart. That there is a design at the very beginning, a rhythm at the very beginning of life. Is that what they meant? And then that God said, search and know us forever, as if as we're flying out to the ends of the earth and the, taking the wings of the morning, God says, oh, the rhythm of your life is never unknown to me, even when you would hide your deeds. Well, after this baby was born, those pre-birth rhythms continued. Maybe some of you have experienced this. She had her own little waking and sleeping rhythm. It had really no connection to my own need for rest. She had a pattern of hunger that was often and nursed around the clock, more or less, with little naps of 45 minutes to an hour. And for the early days and weeks and months, I gave myself over to the rhythm of this child's life. When she was hungry, I was there. Before this even happened, before she cried for milk, my own body ached for release. My rhythms were so controlled by her that once when she slept through a meal, I was in such pain, I had to wake her up and say, eat! I have shaped my life around your rhythms, little one. Don't change now. It hurts too much. But a time came, you see, when her little world couldn't just go with her rhythms. We needed to teach this child other rhythms, the rhythms of the household, the rhythms of day and night, the rhythms of at the table and away from the table, the rhythms of silence. I taught my child silence at an early age, what it meant to wait in silence. It can be taught to the very young. and the rhythm of weeping and laughing. She had to be incorporated into the rhythm of our family in order that she become part of the rhythm of a larger community. Part of it was in order that a divorce did not occur in this family. Part of it was opening up the door of the possibility of a second child. But a larger part of it was inviting her into a human rhythm that meant her life could be connected to the lives of others, that she could learn to walk together with those who are walking with her now, so that she could learn the rhythms of life and worship. What we do on Sunday morning, seen from the perspective of this child and her rhythms, is really not unrelated to how we pattern life in a home, or in a community, or in a nation. The many are gathered into one as we learn a rhythm together. The smallest of children thrive in the security of some known and predictable patterns. Now, there was a time when child rearing theory, you know, let them sprout up wild like alfalfa, and at the end of time, God will separate the wheat from the weeds or something. As my friend Nikki Day said of one person whom I won't name, he wasn't raised, he just grew. But I think we've come home to an understanding more ancient that children don't just sprout up, they need also to be patterned into the life of human community. And those patterns differ in different hemispheres and under different parts of the sky. The roots of the rhythm, I think, are embedded in creation. I ask you for a minute to try to begin to remember the roots of rhythm from which we've become more distanced than Joseph is in Paul Simon's song. Try to imagine that we are part of one of the very first human communities on the face of the earth, near an estuary somewhere, perhaps a delta in the southern hemisphere, the Nile, perhaps, or where the Tigris and the Euphrates meet, where salt and sun and silt are met with water fresh and flowing. We live together there, you and I. And we're making a life with one another. And we're trying to do the human thing, what humans do, striving to survive, to order our existence, and to make meaning with one another. What are some of the patterns and rhythms that we would notice about our environment and our life together in this estuary at the conflux of rivers where sun and silt and salt and water fresh meet? What rhythms would become apparent to us soon? This is a real question. Do you see us there in this estuary, one of the first human communities, Adam, Eve?
Sunrise, sunset.
Sunrise, sunset. Be one of the earliest patterns we see. Yeah, sunrise. One of the earliest patterns we would see is that the sun is not with us all the time. It comes and it goes. And with its going goes the light, and with its coming, the light returns. If you want at another time for me to tell you how I understand those who worship the God of the sun after living in this dark valley, I will tell you, I have a deep empathy for people who bow down in the face of the sun and say, yes, 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 my source of light and hope and grace and serotonin and gladness. So sunrise, sunset, darkness, and night. What other rhythms do we begin to notice?
The tide
goes out and the tide comes in, and sometimes water fresh comes up further on the delta than other times, and it's a mystery to us what makes it move, but being the observant species that we are, it isn't long before one among us says,
"Let's fish, I'm hungry."
Right. Hunger, thirst is a rhythm. But what do we begin to notice about the tide? To what is it connected?
The moon.
The pale yellow moon in Joseph I. And what else? Tom, you can answer this question. The tide, the moon, and...
Rotation.
You were just talking about it at my dinner table today. Maybe it's
inappropriate. Well, it's tied to the orbit, too.
Oh. I was thinking the menstrual cycles. Tom announced to us, "Aren't all women having their period at the same time at Holden?" No. You gotta be on guard mode to figure that out. But we do begin to notice the rhythms of tide and moon and even bodily rhythms. I mean, maybe Adam doesn't figure it out right away, but Eve figures this out, that there are rhythms in her own body, and that they change with time and season and age, and the hunger and thirst, and there are seasons when the land is more fecund, and seasons when it's more fallow. There are times of abundance, and times of less, of feast and fast. What else do we recognize? The creatures coming and going, the wild beasts slinking off to their dens at daybreak, right? Like in Psalm 104, making it safe for the human being to come out and till the garden. We notice the creatures leaving, maybe some for winter and returning, and begin to watch the flight of swallow and wren and robin, or whatever is living in the estuary. What else?
We sleep and awake,
yeah. We get tired and then we're rested.
Birth and death.
We notice one day that the largest one among us is now two. It's pretty oblique. I mean, that you know, there's one who becomes grand and great among us, and then after hard work and sweat and pulsing and breathing and bleeding, there are two. How long is the birth? Jesus said plainly, "Lazarus is dead." And we notice too that we age, don't we? We shrink, we sag, we bend, we grow wiser as we do. And then one day we wake up dead. And then the people wonder what to do with this one who one moment was breathing, and some years before, the story goes, became so big she became three after hard work. And they tell the story of her beginning, and of her gardening, and of her eating and sleeping and loving, and the pulse of love in her veins, of the dividing of her body into more, and there she is breathing no more. And we gather and say, how do we make meaning of this? Or of the one who went out to find food and did not return, or came back maimed, who went too long without water fresh and withered and died, the one who tried to drink the water salt out of great thirst and found only that thirst grew greater. And we begin to gather around these stories and these rhythms and say, How will we live through the night when it is dark without fear? How can we abandon ourselves to sleep and powerlessness when the sun disappears into the water? How will we marvel and rejoice that one can labor and sweat and bleed and scream and seem to be dying and yet bring forth another one, little and screaming and alive? Underneath our liturgy, I am convinced, are all of these rhythms. And when we begin to make liturgy together in church that is disconnected from sunrise and sunset and season fecund and fallow and dying and being born and suffering and rejoicing and feasting and fasting, we create something that is disconnected from the pulsing of love in God's veins, that is disconnected from the rhythm of the universe, from the rhythm of life itself. And then it is no wonder that those who come to our doors say, "What has this got to do with me?"